And good morning once again, everyone. Welcome to the other side of midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn, when the things we look at in daytime, and we say, oh, give me a break, when we look at it this time of night, it's a little different story. Something may be there. And those somethings we pursue, and we try, in the words of my guest last week, James Burke, to make connections. Well, we're going to make some major connections tonight. I'm going to introduce my guest in a moment, but first I want to give you a couple of headlines at the top of the hour here. We have our first poll results turned into votes in New Hampshire, actual primary votes. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there that when I mention even hint at politics, they cringe, they turn the dial, they do whatever. Look, folks, connections aside, this is probably the most important election in our lifetime. I know every election cycle that said, I have good reason to believe it's true this time, because Dixville Notch just voted. They vote right after midnight in New Hampshire, Eastern Time. And CNN was there with live cameras and a lot of other people, like 30 reporters up in this little tiny town in the tippy-tippy top of New Hampshire, which no one goes to, although I understand they're building a $140 million resort up there. I wonder if Trump had anything to do with that. Anyway, Dixville Notch voted, and the results came out like this. They had nine votes. Nine. Hyperdimensional tetrahedral line. Okay. Trump got two. Kasich got three, the governor of Ohio. And Hillary got none, and Sanders got four. Now, that is obviously only trivia because there's no statistical significance whatever to those results. But be that as it may, tomorrow night, on tomorrow night's show, or tomorrow morning show, actually, New Hampshire will have voted, and we will all know. And I'm going to bring on Steve Bassett at the top of the hour to talk about Hillary and give us an update on Edgar Mitchell. And then we're going to have open hailing frequencies and among other things, and I mean, we don't have to obviously talk about only this tomorrow night, tomorrow morning. I think we ought to talk about the election because, look, we live in a, you know, republic / democracy. The kind of democracy is practiced in New England, where I used to live for many, 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 many years, is enviable. It's really an extraordinary experience, and I wish that people could just go through it at least once to see how real democracy operates at the grassroots level. And that's why Dixville Notch is symbolically important. Well, speaking of symbolism, I want to wish everyone a happy Chinese New Year. This is today, this is the Chinese New Year. It's the, I think it's on the lunar calendar. It is the year of the monkey. So that also has interesting symbolic connections to things that may happen later this year, and we'll get into that as the year progresses. My guest tonight is Robert Sullivan IV. I have to find out about the first, second, third. Robert's a philosopher, an historian, an antiquarian, a jurist, a theologian, a radio and TV personality, a writer, a lawyer, and best-selling author of the books The Royal Arch of Enoch, The Impact of Masonic Ritual, Philosophy, and Symbolism. That came out in 2012. And then the newer one is Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies, published in 2014. He's currently writing a third book, Cinema Symbolism 2, more esoteric imagery from popular movies, as well as his first work of fiction, A Pact with the Devil, the story of Elizabeth Birnblack and her involvement with the occult, black magic, and the dark arts. You know, they always used to tell me when I was writing books that, you know, the shorter the title, the better. That's, Robert, that's kind of a long title. Good morning and welcome to the other side of midnight.
Good morning, Richard. Thanks for having me back on. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, as they used to say, and that, actually this time it's really true, by popular demand, I mean, your show created a huge tsunami of reaction. And the reason is we only had 2 hours and we had 2 centuries worth of information to go through. So we still have that same problem tonight. So let me tell you where I want to start. In your first book on the Royal Arch, you go into some detail, which, again, is so complex and so so interconnected that I think we need to go through some of this again. Why don't you start with the basic premise of Masonry, Freemasonry? What is Freemasonry? Who is involved in Freemasonry these days? Do any of us know Masons? Is the Masonic organization some deep, dark, you know, side of the dark side entity, or is it in fact totally misunderstood? Why don't you start kind of like we know nothing and give us a few minute reprise of what Freemasonry consists of in the 21st century?
Boy, oh boy, I'll certainly try. That's, I could probably spend probably the rest of the evening talking on that one. It's a modern, again, a lot of this is, you know, depends on who you want to talk to. It officially comes onto the history scene in 1717 in England. There were Masonic lodges that existed prior to then in Scotland, on the continent of Europe, stone-cutting guilds, you know, Masonic lodges. But it officially comes, you know, is recognized in London in 1717. It's a secret society. It has initiation rituals. I've been through it. I don't think there's anything dark or evil about it. I've talked to people who have gone through it or have done the first degree and have dropped out and thought it was too esoteric for them, too arcane. That's a rarity, but it does happen. And it exists today. It exists all over the world. It was very, very, very popular during the founding days of this country. And it still is. It had a major backlash against it in the 1820s in the United States, where a lot of Masonic temples were wiped out. But it did survive it. And this is Blue Lodge Freemasonry I'm talking about. This is degrees 1, 2, and 3 of Freemasonry that you have to complete in order to be a Freemason. There is a high degree system as well. If Blue Lodge Freemasonry comes in 1717, the high degrees come years later. And this is ultimately, they ultimately get transformed into today what is the two primary high degree bodies, known as the York Rite and the Scottish Rite. And you can only join them after you complete the first 3 degrees of Blue Lodge Freemasonry. As it exists today, it's a fraternal order. It does a lot of charity work. There was somewhat, after this backlash in the 1820s, there was a distancing of any sort of esoteric or mystical themes going on in the lodge. They're still there, but the lodge took the attitude of, oh, we're just a charity organization. If it had continued to embrace the mystical side of things, it probably would have gone out of business.
Why would you think that?
Well, there was what happened was in the 1820s there was this exposure of what's called the William Morgan Affair. It was in the 1820s, so say it was on 1825, and it had to do with a lot of high degree Masons working across state lines to formulate policy behind closed doors. It was somewhat of a conspiracy, although the guys involved would have told you it was completely benign. Nevertheless, it was exposed. There was a man who was exposing this named William Morgan. This is where the term the Morgan Affair comes from. It's named after him. And he was taken across he was taken into Canada, and he disappeared, presumed killed. There was a kangaroo court. A lot of the Masons involved were acquitted. I mean, it was this massive backlash. So if Masonry had stood by this idea that it was this occult order, this would have just made matters worse for the obvious reason. I mean, you know, it would have looked like this is some sort of, you know, evil, you know, occult, you know, mystical order. And, you know, it would have gone out of business at all, but it went out of business anyway. But that would have definitely been the death knell for it. So Masonry just took on the stance of, well, we're just a fraternal order that does, you know, some rituals that are by and large meaningless based on the Bible. That's all it is. We do charity work. We help widows and orphans. And that's it. And Masonry survives the attack, but it gets wiped out. I mean, a lot of Grand Lodges close. A lot of local chapters close. It does survive it, and it does begin to rebound. But it it's with this philosophy of that we're just this fraternal order that does charity work, and it's really this philosophy that carries Masonry. This is in the United States. I'm talking really through most of the 19th century, and even through most of the 20th century. And it's really not until you get into the advent of the internet. Where this material is so much more readily available, that there has been, I would say, probably in the last 7 or 8 years, this mystical revival of Freemasonry, where people are joining it due to the esoteric symbolism, the esoteric teachings, the esoteric tone undercurrents of the rituals, both in the Blue Lodge and the High Degree. This definitely seems to be underway. Freemasons usually, you know, they're easy to spot. Not all of them are, of course.
How are they easy to spot?
Well, they usually wear...
I mean, that's not saying Muslims are easy to spot, or Catholics are easy to spot, or Baptists,
Yeah, it's usually, it's not everyone. A Freemason usually wears a lapel pin or a ring with the square and compasses on it, or if they're in the Scottish Rite, they'll wear the ring with the double-headed eagle on it.
Is this a membership ring that everyone who joins the order wears or has to wear?
No. It's not. It's not required.
Oh, so you could be a Mason and never tell anybody.
You can never tell anybody.
Okay, so there's no way to tell if anybody's a Mason.
I'm sorry?
There's no way to tell if anybody's a Mason.
Unless they come out and, you know, if they're wearing the ring or lapel pin, or if you go in their office and their degree certificate's hanging on the wall or something like that, or you go into their home and their degree certificate's hanging on the wall, that would certainly be one way of knowing
that. That would be a clue.
But there is really no formal requirement to wear a lapel pin or a ring. You could completely keep it secret. I would caveat that with saying if you become a celebrity or you become famous through politics or movies or something like that, it usually becomes well known that you're a Mason because the local lodge that you belong to likes to brag about it, likes to brag about your Masonic membership, and certainly Masonic publications usually will tout famous members.
Okay, remind me.
So if you become famous, you become well known.
Remind me later in the program when we get into discussing Masonry and symbolism and cinema, movies, one of my favorite subjects, because movies are where we all get our views of the world, that and, of course, television. I'm going to ask you about a specific director, and I want you to, if you know the backstory, go into it a bit, but we'll hold off on that. Let me return to the to the 19th century.
Sure.
You say that through the 19th century, Masonry, Freemasonry, became more and more involved in clandestine, secret political agendas. Is that an accurate statement?
No. I would say that was the case up until 1825.
Okay, well, that's the 19th century.
Yeah, post 1825... That is pretty much cleansed out of Freemasonry.
Oh, but from the founding of the country, because I want to go back to the founding of the country in a second, but
sure.
I want to do this interregnum period first. So from the founding of the country to 1825, Masonry is proceeding. We know it was heavily involved politically in the founding of the nation. That's what I want to get to in a moment. But what I want to come up to is this interesting idea that you say that after 1825 and the Morgan Affair, and there was a guy named Clinton involved very heavily, governor of New York.
Right.
I remember from the last show.
Sure.
Let's see, what else? What else is involved in there? Well, after this really dramatic unveiling of secret agendas in a supposedly esoteric society, you say that the lodges, the order, the institution, basically became just like a fraternal celebratory organization, and it dropped all interest or pretense or involvement in actually affecting political change. Is that an accurate statement?
It's pretty accurate. It certainly sort of dropped the attitude of forming policy behind closed doors. You still had politicians and famous people and presidents who were Masons, and it still was influential. But what was sort of gone was the behind locked doors of politically involved Freemasons crafting policy behind closed doors in an unelected setting.
Okay.
That was pretty much disposed of. But you still had Masons who went on to become presidents, you know, speakers of the House, senators, you know, House of Representatives. But the Witt Clinton, you know, Illuminati was somewhat disposed of after 1825.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. We have heavy political involvement of Masons. We know historically the Founding Fathers, a lot of them were Masons, some of the major guys, Ben Franklin, etc. And then through up to 1825, we have political involvement, and then it got out of hand. It became very, very, what's the word? It became clandestine. And then it all erupted in this event in 1820, around the mid-1820s, where the, you know, Clinton was involved with the Morgan thing and all that. Now, here's my question. How do we know that at that point in history, of the order, that it did totally turn its back on and reject all political involvement and political machinations and become only a fraternal organization? To me, that sounds like a wonderful cover. So the lodges split into two. One, just a fraternal group where you just basically have ordinary membership and you get together for potlucks and you go and you raise money for, you know, crippled kids and all that. And then you have another side of Masonry that is what people are concerned about, intimating is still out there, and that's the side of Masonry which is involved heavily, deeply, and clandestinely to this day. And again, this is just a scenario.
Right.
With the direction of the country, the direction of the planet, the direction of human evolution, all of the big, big things that Masonry grapples with. And then you wind up looking at the history of presidents, and you just mentioned it. We have an awful lot of presidents in this country who, in fact, are Freemasons. And Harry S. Truman, you know, 33rd degree, wearing his regalia, looking like some Abyssinian general, to me, I just want to know, are we sure that Masonry went completely civilian, or did it split and the civilian part is in fact a convenient cover?
No, I think it went civilian, but I think what happened was, the Masonic lodges, the reason we know this is they got wiped out.
Or just a few?
Oh, most of them. In Maryland where I am, I want to say 75% of the lodges closed. It got pretty much wiped out.
Wiped out, or it reordered itself.
It got wiped out.
Okay.
People were fired if you were a Freemason. School teachers wanted to teach the children of Freemasons. In Vermont, the Grand Lodge closed, and you couldn't even join. I would answer your question this way. I would definitely say that, you know, that this whole idea, that the DeWitt Clinton Illuminati disappears. I mean, Clinton dies shortly thereafter. I think DeWitt Clinton dies around 1826, 1827. He is the guy doing all this. When he dies and the Morgan affair, this stuff all dies with it. But I would say this, when you go forward with this, through the 19th century, it's sort of the opposite is almost happening, where you have people who are Masons who are in politics, and it's almost the reversal of what's going on. It's where they are, and this is when you get into the 20th century with the Harry Trumans and the Franklin Roosevelts and the people like that, is you have people who are politicians who are Masons and are using the teachings of Freemasonry to mold them, to mold their political views. It's almost the opposite is happening, where before you had guys going into the lodge and perhaps having their politics molded within the lodge, where now you're having people go into the lodge, are impressed with the, you know, egalitarian, democratic symbolism and philosophies of the lodge, and it's affecting them outwardly. So it's almost like a reverse is going on. And it's certainly post 1825. You still have You know, I mean, masonry. Granted, it takes a major backlash, but it does survive it.
Robert, hang on a second. I have a real anomaly I want to present to you. I've been monitoring the White House Christmas cards for some years now, particularly when Obama was elected. And I see, with my untrained, untutored eye, astonishing Masonic symbolism in something as innocuous as the current White House Christmas card. I don't have one handy, and I don't have one up on Other Side of Midnight right now, tonight. But if you go back, if you Google, you know, White House Christmas cards, you'll see a whole list of them, a whole series of, you know, images. The one from last year or the year before had a stunning view of, I believe it's the cross hall in the White House, which has this black and white, you know, Masonic square floor. It's blatantly there. No one talks about it, but it's obviously, and there were pillars, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff. I mean, I'd love to have you look at the card and kind of decode the symbolism. My point being, what better way to have a secret organization that has created a nation, which is what the Masons did with the United States, and we'll get into that in a minute, than to, when it runs into real problems because some people go off the reservation and do horrible things, you basically cut back, you restructure, you reorganize, you make everyone think you reformed, and you take all the interesting policy stuff that will impact the citizenry of the United States, you take that secret, you take that dark, and you don't ever let on again that you're interested in anything like that. And I just want to know, how do we know that isn't going on?
Well, the evidence points the exact opposite way.
What about my Christmas card?
Well, I mean, you could, you know, you can't say every time you see a black and white floor that it's Masonic. You know, I mean, you know, we'd be, you know, spinning round and round forever on that. But you know, you have to look at the historical context, and within the United States, I mean, Masonry still survives and it's still important, and people are still coming out of it who are, you know, heavy hitters on the historical scene. The Witt Clinton secret core group, you know, that's running the show is dead in 1825, and there is zero evidence. I mean, now you have, you have operative Masons who are architects, things like that, who are still using this material, which is somewhat Masonic, but, you know, gets into sacred geometry that ties into Masonry. But you could also say, you know, that it's not also. But, you know, by and large, this idea of the secret, now what does happen is people still believe it. Post 1825, people—it's just what you said. People still want to believe that there is this secret cabal of Freemasons running the show, despite the fact that there is really, really hardly any evidence of this.
Well, but the problem is, Robert, the evidence is all around us. We just have to pay attention. I mean, I have done 30 some years of research into the Masonic and esoteric symbology involved in NASA missions. And in all aspects of NASA's activities, Masonic symbolism is overwhelmingly present. And
I totally agree with that.
And James Webb, who was the second NASA administrator picked by John Kennedy, handpicked by John Kennedy to run NASA, was a 33rd degree Mason. When you read the connection between Kennedy's vision for the United States and Webb's vision for the United States in so-called 21st century space age America, the Masonic ideals shine through. So I just have to wonder out loud, are we going down a false path when thinking that Masonry is only about having parties and, you know, supporting charitable events, when in fact the symbolism that comes out again and again and again seems to indicate there's a very active, very proactive agenda to try to guide the evolution of the United States in a better and bigger direction?
Well, I think what you're saying is true, but I would see that as more of people who are involved in it's what I said before. It's the idea of Masons who are Masons using the teachings of Freemasonry to unilaterally or even somewhat together, you know, using it as a teaching device and using its symbols outwardly, but that doesn't mean that there is some sort of hidden hand in Masonry telling them to do that. It's people who join it and then get impressed with it and then use its symbols, use its teachings outwardly.
And how can you tell the difference?
Is the way I see it happening.
Okay, so this is your analysis, but actually, do we have any data that this separation actually, in fact, occurred?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty much historical, you know, fact that the William Morgan affair happened. Masonry got wiped out, and you know it survives it, but I mean it takes years for it to come back.
Look, we now have in the 21st century all kinds of indications that Masonic ideals and ideas and symbolism totally surround us. When we get into the film stuff in a little while, you're going to regale us with example after example after example, and yet you're telling me that Masons are just folks that like to get together and have a good time.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying that people who join Masonry then use its teachings to formulate. You use the teachings of Freemasonry to affect you, and then you as a person go out, and if you become elected, you can, you know, the teachings of the lodge and the Masonic symbolism. It's the exact opposite. It was prior to 1825. It was people were being drawn into this, and Masonry was itself formulating policy. Post 1825, you have people joining Masonry, and using its teachings unilaterally going forward. So it's almost like a reverse effect going on, and I think it's very powerful. I mean, I don't dispute that it's happening, and I don't dispute the NASA stuff, and you know, you'll find the stuff in cinema and the mystery schools and all that. But you know, this idea that within Masonry, post 1825, the secret cabal running the show seems to, you know, I mean, maybe it does survive. I mean, I guess it's certainly possible.
Okay, congratulations. You get a gold star.
But let me clear it up. I certainly don't believe that.
Why? When did any organization... Well, hang on. Robert, why did any organization ever voluntarily quit political power if they use that power to create something as extraordinary as the United States of America?
Well, they had to. There were lynch
mobs. You say they had to, but all you do then is you go underground. You basically...
Well, how do you do that?
Ah.
Where are you going to meet? Where are you going to meet? If you can't rent buildings. The guys, I mean, people lose jobs. People are thrown out of power. I mean, you know, if you were a Mason in 1825, you, your wife, and children were all but homeless. At that point in time, I mean, your child couldn't be taught by you. There were school professors who wouldn't teach children of Masonry. I mean, this is well documented. I mean, Masonry in 1825 is all but completely wiped out. Masonry to survive, if there was any indication that there was a secret cabal surviving this, it would have gone out of business without question. It would have completely have gone 100% out of business. The only reason it didn't this is where you have the formation of the third party in the United States. It's the Anti-Mason Party. It was founded right here in Baltimore, Maryland. The convention was not too far from where I'm sitting right now, in downtown Baltimore. I mean, it was the first third party created in the United States political party. I mean, what's it called? The Anti-Masons.
Okay.
I mean, that tells you what their agenda is.
I don't want to see, Skype has a kind of an unsettling delay. So when I say something, you don't hear it. And when you say something, I don't hear it. So we have to get our signals.
Right.
You know, Skype is not like having a phone call into a radio station. It's a little more complex. Anyway, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's hold it there. I find this discussion absolutely amazingly interesting because of what's going to be coming next on the other side of the break. And to take us there, here's our friend Bobby Bright from Down Under. Here on the other side of midnight, my guest this morning is Robert Sullivan, the fourth. Maybe we should ask where the first, second, and third were. Anyway, my name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
There's things I don't see, things I don't hear. And simple things confuse me when they ought to be clear. It ain't appealing, it's feeling. Paying for my younger days.
And we are back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Robert Sullivan. Robert, let's skip back now in time, a century and a half. Let's go back to the founding of the country, because this is kind of the premise that I'm coming from. Masons basically created the United States out of almost nothing except a few remarkably impressive ideas that came from a variety of sources, including, you know, Native Americans. And it's their political power in creating this experiment that makes me think that no one would voluntarily just eliminate or dismiss or, you know, kind of relinquish that kind of power. Why don't we talk a bit about the founding of the country and the Masons who were involved?
Right. Sure. You definitely have a heavy, heavy Masonic influence. I call it in the Royal Arch, I call the United States the first Masonic Republic. I think that's pretty much irrefutable. I don't dispute that one bit at all. And again, you have you have the founders of this country, you know, formulating this nation. They knew what they didn't want. They didn't want a monarchy, and they didn't want a Vatican-styled religious organization. They wanted freedom of religion. They wanted democracy. So, okay, well, where do we turn to? We can find these exact same values. Let's turn to Freemasonry. And a lot of the founders, George Washington, Franklin, a lot of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, the United States Constitution. Some of the names escape me right now, but yeah, I mean, definitely you have a heavy, you know, Masonic, influence. I mean, you have the constitutions of the Freemasons written in 1821 by James Anderson. In that you will find the prototype, of the separation of church and state. Where Anderson in 1721 says in his constitution that there's no religious requirement in order to become a Freemason. You just have to believe in a supreme being. That's the kernel that ultimately becomes the separation of church and state. You have the triple division of government in the United States. This ties into Blue Lodge Freemasonry, with the triple division of government in the Blue Lodge between the worshipful master and the two wardens. When you get into the founding of this country, you get into the 1776 to 1789 time frame with the design of this country, you will definitely find a heavy Masonic influence. You will probably even find a more heavier Masonic influence post 1799, post the death of George Washington. And again, this is through the governor of New York, DeWitt Clinton, who is the Illuminati Grand Master, for lack of a better word, you know, running the country. And you will find Masonic symbolism just all over the place, with some of the architectural projects going on from 1799 onward. And really between that time and up until William Morgan, that's really the golden age of Masonry, probably in the United States. You have in 1801 the formulation of the Scottish Rite, that's set up in Charleston, South Carolina in 1801. You had high degree bodies floating around the United States, but it's really in 1801 that the Scottish Rite comes on. In the late 1790s, you had Thomas Smith Webb publish his Illustrations of Freemasonry. This documented a high degree system of Freemasonry that ultimately becomes the York Rite of Freemasonry, which is the other high degree body within the United States. So, yeah, I mean, you definitely have, with the founders, just even going back to 1776 with your correct Benjamin Franklin, I mean, he definitely, without question, when he was in France negotiating the French to get involved, there was a lodge in Paris, which was very famous, very powerful, called the Lodge of the Nine Sisters. Franklin was a member of that. Without question, he used his influence, and it was through the Nine Sisters that he probably got the French committed to American independence. There was another Freemason who was the founder of the United States Navy.
Wait,
Jones.
Are you saying that it was Masonry that got Lafayette involved in helping the American Revolution?
That's probably true. Lafayette was a Freemason. And certainly a lot of Washington's generals were Freemasons. Franklin was a Mason, was former Grand Master of the state of Pennsylvania. When he went to Paris, when he went to France to woo the French into becoming our allies, there is a very famous Masonic lodge in Paris called the Temple of the Nine Sisters that Franklin ultimately wound up joining. I mean, he was a Mason from an American lodge, but you can, you know, once you're a Mason, you're always a Mason. You can, you know, move around to lodges. That's what they used to say
about people in the CIA.
Well,
once in the CIA, always. Well, see, this goes back to my point. Because, Robert, I don't know whether you're being graciously naive or, in fact, you really don't believe that what I'm proposing might have happened, but when you have a body, an institution that has created this extraordinary experiment, God, and I sound like Rubio now because I'm repeating myself word for word, if, in fact, horrible things did happen, which they did, is it logical to assume that everybody just said, okay, never mind, we're just going to have some parties now, or they split into two, the civvies, the civilians, and then the real stuff to continue guiding the country went deep underground. And that's kind of why we see only one indicator that something like this may be going on, which is how many presidents statistically compared to the country happen to be A, Freemasons, and B, very, very rich, and C, related.
Well, the thing is, well, there's very few Masonic presidents, very few. I mean, it's 14 of them. The last Masonic president was Gerald R. Ford. We haven't had a Masonic president since then.
That we know of.
You know, well, there would be no reason to keep it secret.
Of course there would. If there's a hidden agenda, in other words, you only see the guys that are playing at the... It's just a fraternal organization.
No, it doesn't work this way.
How do you know? It doesn't work this way. Well, tell me how.
I've been involved with it for 20 years.
Okay.
And when someone in politics... becomes a, you know, if there's someone elected president, believe me, the home lodge and the lodge that they are members of will brag about this in every Masonic publication you can think of to no end, because the reason you don't keep it secret, and it makes no sense to keep it secret, and it's completely illogical to keep it secret, is it's the greatest recruiting tool on the planet. So when you have a president become a Mason, it is lauded all over the place, and I can tell you with 100% certainty that is the case, because I am a Mason, have been one for 20 years, and I get all the literature. And as soon as someone famous becomes a Freemason, it is plastered all over the place from start to finish. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal, the basketball player, when he became a Mason, there was no end to that. So, you know, if someone in politics or someone, you know, famous becomes a Mason, believe me, it is plastered all over the place in these Masonic publications. You can't escape it. And the reason for this is it is one of the greatest recruiting tools out there. Hey, look, you know, so-and-so's a Mason, you know, now you should join.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is absolutely
But Robert, again, what better recruiting tool? You lead them in the front door on the civilian side. They go through various sets of tests and filters and the whole ritual of initiation and all that. Then they get up in the higher degrees to 32nd degree. And then you pick the people that you want to get into the other side to do whatever it is that they're doing over there. Again, this is a scenario, but you don't tell anybody about that. I mean, I just would like to see why we seem to have this anomalous contradiction that you tell me that Masonry now is simply a fraternal group that's doing good works and basically had to regress from avid political objectives in the 1800s, in the mid-1820s, but we have all these Masonic symbols up to and including. Did you and I the last time talk about Obama's inauguration?
Yes.
And that remarkable, amazing kind of semi-secret ceremony in the map room facing the Washington Monument with Orion and Sirius at the right angles, hyperdimensionally and all that, and the Chief Justice giving him the only one in the room giving him the oath, and the only photographer taking a picture, catty-corner, of the portrait over the fireplace, that was moved specifically from another room to that room for that night, and it was Latrobe, the guy, the big Mason who basically helped design Washington's most important architecture. And you're telling me that masonry has nothing now to do esoterically, in a hidden sense, with evolution guiding the country without letting people know that's what they're still doing?
Well, I haven't seen the ceremony.
I'll send you the pictures.
I would have to see it.
It's on the Enterprise mission website. I'm trying to think what I called the paper, because it was so astonishing. It was such amazing visual proof that what we see in public is not what we're getting behind the scenes. And I've been watching Obama very carefully. Obama's administration, his two terms, have been studded with Masonic symbolism. And yet you tell me that he's not a Mason. Well, if he wasn't registered with any of the known lodges in the public lists, how would we ever know?
Well, he's not a Mason.
But how do you know?
Well, because it would
be... Is there a commandment that says when you become a Mason, you have to make it public? It's like I asked before in the last, top of the show, do you have to wear the regalia, the pins, and et cetera? And you said no, which means you could be a closet Mason and never let anybody know, right?
The question answers itself, because if he was a Mason, the lodge that he belonged to would publicize it all over the place.
No, you're claiming that, but there's no proof. Why would they? If it's a secret, if there's
underground... I'm going to tell you why, because it's a recruiting tool. It would help generate membership. I can tell you with 100% certainty, as someone who has been involved with this, that the last president we had who was a Freemason was Gerald R. Ford. There has been no president since Gerald R. Ford that has been a Freemason. And it is the exact opposite of what you're saying. If a person in politics goes on to become a Freemason, the home lodge and the home grand lodge that this person is a member of would promote it all over the place. There would be no reason. It would make no sense to keep that secret. So, there would be no reason to keep that secret in any way, shape, or form. It would be the exact opposite.
It would be
pronounced all over the place.
Somehow, I think we're talking past each other. I don't think you're hearing what I'm saying.
Go ahead.
If there, in this scenario, if masonry split in 1825 into a public version that was safe and banal and had no political designs, was not a threat, was not any of the boogeymen that were plastered all over the headlines when the whole Clinton affair took place, if they went underground and another section formed, how would we even know, other than by the symbology that we see in public, that would be inescapable if they were proceeding along ritual paths that required public symbolism? But they never would explain the public symbolism. Like, no one ever described the scene on Pete Souza's photograph of Obama taking the oath with Justice Roberts that time of night at 19.5 military time in the map room, looking at the obelisk representing George Washington, first Mason, with Orion glittering over it in the skies of Washington, D.C. If that's not a Masonic ritual, what the hell was it?
Well, I'd have to see it. I can't.
Well, hang on, Robert. Do you trust me?
Well, I don't have these pictures in front of
me.
I'm not going to comment on something I haven't seen. It's like asking me to review a movie that I haven't seen.
No, it's not.
I'm not going to comment on it.
I'm describing a scene that exists. You can Google. Just Google Obama second oath and
I'm not in front of my computer right now.
Well, when you get off, you might do that. I will go to enterprisemission.com. I will find, or my producer will find, the paper that I wrote on this remarkable demonstration of secret Masonic symbolism in the second unnecessary oath. Remember how Obama flubbed the oath?
Well, the Chief Justice mispronounced his middle name, I believe it was.
No. They got the sequence of phrases out of sequence, and Obama had trouble finding, and it looked like Justice Roberts was leading him. In other words, it seemed to me like a setup, so they would have a second secret ceremony, and no one would know what was going on, because it occurred at a different astrological time of day, and it was the day after, and that makes a big difference in terms of the astrological symbolism. I just wonder, I'll tell you what, I don't want to keep arguing over and over again. When I send you the data, what I want you to do is look at it carefully, and then I'll have you back on, and we'll talk about it. But to me, the idea, given all the symbology all around us that's Masonic, that Masons just became a fraternal group and that's it, does not pass the smell test.
Oh, I think it passes it overwhelmingly.
We have a difference of opinion.
I think, you know, like I said, I mean, I think you have a very heavy Masonic influence in the country. I don't dispute that. And I certainly don't dispute, you know, when you get into the city planning and the symbols and things like that, that, I mean, you know, I documented, you know, ad nauseum in the book, but, you know, and I think more of today, it's you have people who are joining Freemasonry and are using the teachings of Masonry. It's sort of a reverse going on, are using the teachings of Freemasonry to formulate policy rather than a situation of, you know, of Masonry directing it. But you know, when you get into past 1825, there is just no hardcore evidence that, you know, that there is some sort of secret cabal of Masons. I mean, they all but get wiped out. There's no one there. And Masonry does survive it, and it does rebound eventually. I mean, you know, you still have the High Degrees surviving it. The Scottish Rite survives it. Masonry does survive it. And you still have people coming out of the Masonic Lodge who do go on to become very powerful and influential. But I think it's more of the scenario of, at that point, they're using, Masonry as a guiding device rather than some sort of hidden hand in Masonry guiding them. That's to me where all the evidence points to.
Okay, well, if you're not by your computer, then I can't send you the paper or the image right now, so we will move on. Given that the country tonight is celebrating the beginning of the next part of this astonishing electoral process, talk about grassroots democracy, it just seemed to me tonight to be appropriate to kind of raise the idea that the United States is the first, as you said appropriately, Masonic Republic. So, Robert, I can't understand why you think they just all quit and it just went away.
Well, because in 1825 there was a Masonic backlash. This is irrefutable. This is well documented. And Masonry went out of business, all but. That's how I'm able to come on here and say that.
Okay.
You know, this is completely irrefutable. The only reason Masonry all but survives this is the president at the time, Andrew Jackson, who was a Mason, refused to cave into anti-Masonry. He refused to renounce his Masonic membership, and he refused to renounce Masonry. And Jackson sort of assumes, it's funny because Andrew Jackson at that point sort of assumes this George Washingtonian mantle at the time, and all but becomes this sort of like new 19th century version of George Washington, you know, the military leader who is stalwart and refuses to, you know, and is a Mason, and, you know, he refuses to renounce it, and that's one of the real critical historical you know, pieces of how Masonry survives this is Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, the seventh president of the United States. He refuses to renounce Masonry in the election. I think it's of 1832, maybe 1828. I'd have to go look. The anti-Mason party, which was founded here in Baltimore, the convention was here in Baltimore. The candidate was a man named William Wirt. He eventually, they lose. They get wiped out. This, you know, because of the anti-Masonry defeat, and Andrew Jackson remaining a loyal Mason, this certainly helps Masonry survive the 1825 backlash of the William Morgan affair. That I totally agree with. But again, you know, Masonry takes a massive hit because of it. And, you know, the Masonic presidents, you know, they are there. But you know, I see all the time that every every president was a Freemason and this and that. That's simply not the case. There are a lot of presidents who. The president that Andrew Jackson actually defeated was John Quincy Adams, and John Quincy Adams was a vehement anti-Mason. In fact, anti-Masonry comes into this country through the Adams family. John Adams being the second president of the United States, John Quincy Adams being the sixth president of the United States, Quincy Adams is a vehement anti-Mason and does everything in his power to support anti-Masonry and to wipe Masonry out. So, again, here we have a president
however,
who is very anti-Masonic.
However, John Quincy Adams was the first president who established, among other things, the U.S. Naval Observatory for marking celestial alignments, time, meridian transits, sightings, a network of observation stations for the U.S. government of celestial matters. That's John Quincy Adams, the same guy who said he hated Masonry. But that's a very Masonic thing to do because governments were not involved in that activity at that point in history.
Well, Quincy Adams was very big into, you know, establishing national universities.
Yes.
Exactly what you said. But Quincy Adams was one of the most anti-Mason, anti-Masonic. I mean, what I'm saying is completely historical, documented fact.
But again, Robert, I just want you to open your idea to the possibility that it's a lie, that the documentation we have has been created to make us think it only went away as a really powerful background force, and to make it look innocuous, you'd have to lay out a tableau, you'd have to lay out a whole paper trail, you'd have to have pronouncements, you'd have to have closings, you'd have to have all the stuff you talked about. I just see the symbol still vibrant and alive, and I see policy moving in certain directions, and so I ask the question, did it really die as an esoteric political force from the time of the founding of the nation to 1825, or in fact, is it now in two parts, one we get to see and the one that we don't get to see because they don't want us to?
Yeah, I have seen no evidence of the latter. So
except for the symbolism. Hang on. Robert, you say no evidence. I just told you about some evidence, like the Christmas card in 2015.
But if you're going to tell me every time you see a black and white checkerboard that's Masonic, my answer to that is that's nonsense.
I'm using the black and white checkerboard floor in the White House.
That comes out of the Bible. Okay, that's not Masonic per se. That comes out of the Bible. So, you know, I mean, you know, you can walk into a shopping mall and see black and white checker floors on the floor of a shopping mall. Okay, mm-hmm. That's not Masonic. Okay, that's a design, you know, tableau that's being done to put a floor down with black and white checkerboards. I mean, you know, you can start seeing this stuff everywhere if you look hard enough. And you know, again, if you look at the historical facts, I believe that Masonry is very powerful, and I believe it's very potent, and I believe the symbols, you know, you could craft the argument that the symbols are alive, but if you look at it historically, and you know, you look at it in historical context, you know, all evidence points to the fact that, you know, this secret cabal running the show is gone post 1825. That's what I believe. I've been in Masonry for 20 years, and I have seen no evidence of this whatsoever, of some sort of secret cabal running the thing. I mean, the only way I can answer your question at this point is just to default out of this and say, I guess if it's there, I haven't seen it. But, I mean, you know, if we're going to get into the realm of black and white checkerboards, we're in big trouble because, I mean, this is where, you know, people, I mean, I get this all the time. Of people sending me this stuff, you know, emails, this, that, and it's just nothing to this. I mean, if we're going to go down the path of a black and white checkerboard is Masonic, then my local McDonald's is Masonic because it has a black and white checkerboard, you know, when you walk, you know, into it. I mean, I guess this is evidence that McDonald's is this secret evil corporation, you know, run by the Freemasons. I mean, you know, because it has a black and white checkerboard. I mean, that's biblical. I mean, that comes straight out of the Book of Kings. It's called the Threshing Floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Oh, but that's Masonic. Yeah, I mean,
well, wait a minute. But it was adopted by Masonic lodges all over the world.
Right, but it's adopted by Masons, but it comes out of the Bible first. So I, you know, so? I mean,
but it's not an either so, or. It's not an either
okay,
or.
I mean, okay, so a pillar. You know, okay, when I walk down the street and I see a pillar, okay, Masonry adopts a pillar. You know, when the most important symbol in Masonry is the sun. So I guess when the sun rises in a couple hours here in Baltimore, that's the Freemasons causing the sun to rise. I mean that's the logic that people want to apply to this stuff. And it's nonsense to me. And someone who has been involved with this for 20 years, you know, when I hear stuff like this, there's an all-seeing eye. You know, well, that predates Masonry. That comes out of the, you know, Renaissance as a symbol for deity. Oh, but there it is. Say, oh, that's the Masons. You know, I mean, come on. I mean, you know, you can see this stuff everywhere if you look hard enough for it. And people want to see this as this overwhelming, overarching, you know, evidence of this, you know, vast Masonic conspiracy. And it just doesn't exist.
Okay.
I mean,
All right.
I give you that. You know, I don't dispute that, you know, this country was founded upon Freemasonry. I'll give you the Masonic symbols. I'll give you the sacred architecture. I'll give you the dollar bill. I don't dispute that. I'll give you, you know, the Erie Canal, Union College. See, no one talks about those.
And I'll tell you what, you know, we're at the bottom of the hour. So we have a break coming up. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to see your, all-seeing eye. And I'm going to raise you one Obama Christmas card. Anyway, we're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Robert Sullivan. We're having what would be called, at a multi-metaphorical level, a spirited discussion. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. This morning it's much warmer here in the land of enchantment. It's actually 30 degrees. Remember, it was down in the teens last week. Okay, Robert, let's move on to movies. I mean, I love symbolism in movies. I was watching a Captain America movie the other night. I was waiting to do an interview with KABC in Los Angeles, and I had an hour or two to kill. And it's a three-hour movie, and I thought, okay, I can start it, I can look at it again. Because every time I look at these films, I see more stuff. They are putting so much symbolism in modern movies, it's not a joke. And you have written a book, and you're working on your second book. So let me take a deep breath and ask you, where does this symbolism in movies come from? And start out by giving us some interesting examples that you've been watching.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you get into to movies, yeah, you will definitely find a lot of esoteric imagery in there. You know, this I don't dispute, you know, in any way, shape, or form. There's a lot of, you know, I've wrestled with this as to why this appears to be the case. I believe it to be intentionally done. I believe a lot of these filmmakers are much more well-versed in this material than they let on. You have it in Hollywood. I'm constantly having to remind that in a stone's throw from Hollywood, you have Manly P. Hall's Philosophical Research Society, which is literally a stone's throw from the movie-making industry. And that is a vast library filled with esoteric literature on the mystery schools. So, I definitely... when it comes to esoteric symbolism, I do believe most of it is intentional. I think you can craft an argument for some of it perhaps being accidental or coincidental. I think when that's the case, you turn to the world of the psychiatrist Carl Gustav Jung, and we are in the realm of the collective unconscious, mm-hmm. of archetypes and symbols being part of this vast unconscious treasure trove of symbolism that affects us one way or the other. And since movies are an artistic expression, probably one of the most powerful artistic expressions, they turn up regardless of the filmmaker or the producer's intent. Certainly there seems to be evidence of that. But I think when it comes to a lot of movie symbolisms and symbolism, Again, you have to look at it in the context of the movie. This to me is part of the key study in this. Is the movie a veiled alchemical storyline? Are we dealing with ancient religions? Are we dealing with Gnosticism? Are we dealing with secret societies? A secret society theme, such as you will find in the movie Fight Club, with Brad Pitt and Ed Norton. Are we dealing with numerology? Are we dealing with archetypes? If so, what type? Are we dealing with Tarot embodiment, astrology or astrotheology? Breaking down the context of the movie is very critical to me in helping me understand then at that point, some of the veiled themes and symbols and icons going on inside the movies. Cinema Symbolism is out right now. That's available. I am currently writing Cinema Symbolism 2. That is well underway. I'm really working hard on that. The one movie that I'm working on right now is The Chronicles of Narnia. This is the C.S. Lewis work. I did the J.R.R. Tolkien three Lord of the Rings movies in the first book, and I wanted to pay homage to C.S. Lewis's fellow drinking buddy at Oxford. So I'm doing the three Chronicles of Narnia movies. I just got done watching The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That has some very, very, very deep Neoplatonic Christian allegories in it. And we are also dealing with components of the Joseph Campbell monomyth, which is very powerful, very important. And
now, hang on. Joseph Campbell monomyth, please explain.
Oh, yes. This is very, very critical to this understanding. Joseph Campbell was a very famous American symbolist and mythologist, and he wrote a book. It's a seminal work. I would highly recommend this, especially if you're interested in movie symbolisms, because this has so much to do with it. The name of the story, or excuse me, the name of the book is called The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Mm-hmm.
And he essentially documents what is called the hero's quest. He calls it the monomyth. And this hero's quest is essentially, this is part of the collective unconscious, at least according to Campbell. And this documents sort of what you call the savior archetype, the solar hero, this character who is sort of plucked from everyday life and goes on this epic quest adventure in this savior, Christ-like, a massive epic adventure, and winds up being the savior figure, this redeemer figure almost, saving some sort of magic land or mystical realm from some sort of evil, dark overlord type of archetype, type of character. This naturally is Star Wars. Lucas has admitted this. In fact, the copy of The Hero with a Thousand Faces that I have here actually has a testimonial on the dust jacket from Lucas, talking about how the book influenced Star Wars. The monomyth, you could craft an argument, I suppose, Richard, that you could find certain elements of this, in a lot of movies, but there are some movies that really adhere to it. The Star Wars, the first three Star Wars movies are very, very come straight out of the monomyth. The Matrix movies, which also are very Gnostic, they incorporate the monomyth. Lord of the Rings incorporates it. Harry Potter, The Chronicle of Narnia, the one I was just talking about, the first one, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, has a very, overload of the monomyth in it. And it's a very powerful, according to Campbell, and I agree with him, a very powerful plot device, this hero's quest, that you will find in cinema. So this is some of the material that I took on in Cinema Symbolism, some of the movies in that. I mean, I got into The Exorcist, what are some of the other movies? The James Bond material with Ian Fleming, the occult influence on him with Aleister Crowley.
Let's not do all this en masse. What I'd like to do is I'd like to go through a few films that are really interesting to people that everybody knows, and pick out the symbolism and try to chart a logical course through the symbolism. I had a question come in, like, what does the symbolism mean? Why is symbolism used? What good is symbolism? So let's start there.
Okay, that's a very good question. I believe And I just would caveat this is I have no problem going through movies, but again, I just have to caveat this that it has to be a movie I've seen. I eventually get asked a question about a movie that I haven't seen yet. And again, I'm
that's why I'm asking you to bring up which movie you want to talk about first.
No, that's okay. It's a great question to ask. I get it asked all the time. Is, you know, why do this? Why do this? Why incorporate these symbols and these esoteric themes in movies? And to me, the answer is exactly the same as why an architect would incorporate the sacred ratio, the golden ratio, or the Vesica Pisces, or these astrological alignments into architecture or into a cityscape. And the answer to that is it's the idea behind it, the philosophy behind it is you're drawing on divinity by
You are what?
Go ahead.
You are what?
You're drawing. You're incorporating divinity.
Oh, I thought you said you are trolling on divinity.
You may be doing that too.
You said you are drawing on divinity. Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, you're trying to align your project, whatever it is, with higher powers, the background force, the source of the universe, whatever will help you make it work. That's why you're trying to invoke these higher energies, right? Through symbolism.
Oh, I agree with that. No, I agree with that. You may be trolling it also. That's certainly possible. When an architect, you're drawing on these divine astral powers. It's as above, so below. I mean, I'm drawing a parallel here with sacred architecture, because I'm going to go to the movies in a minute. But what I'm doing is I'm drawing a parallel by incorporating the sacred ratio, the Vesica Pisces, these astral alignments. The idea is the philosophy behind it is, at any rate, is you're absolutely correct. You're drawing on these high spiritual energies. The idea is that the stars in heaven are closer to God than we are, so you're symbolically drawing down divinity, putting it in your cityscape, putting it in your building. And it's almost sort of the same way with a movie, is by incorporating this ancient mythology, these sacred symbols, these ancient themes, ancient religions, archetypes, you're investing the film with a sense of mythology. To me, in my research of this, and people can disagree, that's fine. It's really modern day mythology making is why it's very powerful is why this is being done in movies.
Well, it's all over. I mean, you can't, at least I can't, Robin and I can't watch a movie without seeing astonishing patterns of symbolism. Now, I don't know whether it's, you know, it's like when I was a kid and I bought my first car, after the first car, which was a 1967 red Mustang with a black vinyl roof, looked really cool. You'd be amazed how many red Mustangs with black vinyl roofs I saw on the road. So if you're sensitized to symbolism, will you see symbolism everywhere, or in fact, is there real symbolism, and then our pattern matching part of our brain wants to kind of project and impute that symbolism on a lot of other stuff that isn't real? Do you decide which is real and which is not?
Right. I mean, to me, that's really a key component of all this, is to watch the movie, and it takes me, I would say this, it takes me more than one viewing to do this.
Of course.
And it's just a contextual thing. It's contextual. Am I dealing with like a Neoplatonic theme or ancient religions? And some movies, I mean, I've watched many movies, and you know, some movies I don't see anything. Reservoir Dogs, you know, Pulp Fiction with Quentin Tarantino. I think they're great movies, but I've watched them numerous times. I can't come up with any sort of esoteric themes or symbolism, you know, in them whatsoever. Maybe they're there. You know, I'm certainly not perfect. The movies that I take on in the books are movies that I can really document and pin down these esoteric themes going on. Usually, once I start stumbling upon it, then within that movie, I will start seeing it more and more. And even to this day, there are certain movies that I watch, and I'm still picking up on new material in the movie. You know, so it's more. I mean, I remember last time we were here, when I was here with you, We were talking about The Truman Show, a movie that I've seen numerous times, and you were absolutely correct to point out to me about the whole thing with his mission. His Gnostic quest gets started when the light falls out of the sky, which turns out to be the Egyptian dog star Sirius, lands in his driveway.
Who is Isis?
Yeah, that's right, and you told me that, and I had missed that. The very next day, after I got off the show, I went back to bed, but then the next day I threw the movie on, and there it was. And I was like, my God, how did I miss that?
What's weird is that lamp falls out of the sky. I love your allusion, light falling from the sky, and it lands on the street in front of his house. And it's right in the foreground. It's right in front of the camera, so you see this lamp with the name Sirius on it, and then behind it, going out into the distance, becoming out of focus, is the street and other houses, and other driveways and all that. But it's kind of right there in the beginning, with like, okay, so this is what they're going to do.
Oh, absolutely, and that was one I had missed, and I was like, oh my God, how did I miss that? So I'll have to somehow incorporate that in cinema symbolism too. So the point I'm trying to make is that I've watched certain movies numerous times, but I'm still learning seeing material in these movies. But it's for me, it's just watching the movie. And then discovering, it's really like a contextual thing. I think once the context of the movie, once the esoteric context is figured out, I think then the symbolism of what the director or the producer and the writers are trying to convey becomes, at least for me, easier to decode than it would be otherwise. So for me, my methodology, I suppose, to answer the question, would be to first off discover the context. Am I dealing with religion, Neoplatonic themes, astrology, the occults, numerology, archetypes, and then trying to piece it together and see what this movie is revealing on a very esoteric level.
Did you see the Super Bowl yesterday?
Yes, I did.
Did you see the one last year?
Yes.
Did you note the halftime symbolism, the overwhelming, drenching, dripping, almost aggressive symbolism of last year's halftime?
Well, the halftime show from yesterday, I didn't watch. I had to do something else. I watched the game, but I didn't watch it. The halftime show the year before, the one with Katy Perry, I watched it, but like not really. It was just sort of like on in the background. I usually stretch and take my dog out when the halftime show comes on.
If you're trying to communicate symbolism to, I think yesterday's Super Bowl had, get this, 111.9 million viewers. That number in itself is kind of interesting symbolically. But 100 million people, if you have an opportunity to communicate something that you think is really important at an esoteric level, that's where you're going to do it. That's where your audience is. So I've been watching halftimes for decades, and they're filled with esoteric, yes, even Masonic symbolism. And last year's was vividly remarkable. And the thing that's so interesting, Robert, is that this year's appeared to have none of it.
Really?
Really. The big thing about last night and Beyoncé's, and Coldplay's, big halftime thing was it was basically not symbolic. It was right out there. She's talking about her Negro heritage. She's talking about, in her new song, the Black Panther origins. She got a huge negative response from the former, mayor of New York. And it's so interesting that people are getting down on her for trying to communicate a political message, and they completely missed the Katy Perry tour de force of symbolism 1 year before.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess the Katy Perry one, I'd have to go back and watch before I could comment on it. But
and then we'll have you back.
I know that with the one yesterday, like I said, I usually caught pieces of it. It's one of those things where when it's going on, I kind of watch it in the background. The halftime is when I get up. I got to take my dog out. I get a drink, go to the bathroom. I had it on in the background, but I was only kind of watching it, piecemeal, out of the corner of my eye. But I know there was some backlash. I think, you know, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just speculating on this, that she was supposed to, Beyonce was supposed to be dressed up as Michael Jackson. She was paying homage to Michael Jackson with the cross she was wearing. It was supposed to be referencing some old Michael Jackson costume that I think he wore in the Super Bowl. But again, I'm speculating on that. I'm not saying that's 100% certain.
Just go and take a look, and then you and I will have a conversation. And look at a few of the halftimes, because movies notwithstanding, no movie ever made has at one sitting 111 million people. So if you want to communicate a message, if someone is trying to communicate messages for a reason, the halftime of the Super Bowl is the place to do it. And last year it was stunningly intriguing. And I would just recommend you go and look at a few of them, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about Super Bowl halftime symbolism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely, I'll have to definitely check out the Katy Perry one. No problem. I'll definitely take a look at it.
Just one word. Beware of the sharks.
Oh yeah, the left shark. Yeah. No, I do. Now that I do remember. The one, the left shark was out of sync. I remember that. I do remember that one.
Watch the whole thing very carefully. Okay, I want to change gears here. Remember the last time we did the show? We talked about a major movie which is filled with stunning symbolism that I love, National Treasure.
Oh yes.
And National Treasure 2.
Yes.
Okay. Last night, after the Super Bowl, CBS hosted a live version of Stephen Colbert's new show, The Late Show. And during the show, Colbert used a very interesting device, a football, and he would throw it off camera, and then they would cut to pre-taped celebrities who would catch the football and who would make comments about, you know, the game and all this. And then they would throw it off camera, and then the camera would cut back to Colbert, and he would catch the football. It was a very nice device to go between pre-taped segments that obviously were not connected in time. So the final segment that he throws the football to, you see him throw it off, you know, stage left, and then the camera cuts, and you see the White House and this tall, skinny black guy, which is the way Colbert introduced his receiver, turned out to be the president receiving the football. So then the president says, I think Colbert asked him, well, how can you, because he knew the Broncos had won, okay? But it's pre-taped. Right. So Colbert asks him live on the air, how do you know that the Broncos won? And he says, well, haven't you seen National Treasure 3?
Huh.
So Mr. Obama, the current president of the United States, I think, is up to his eyebrows in esoteric symbolism. My personal opinion is, because of this not announced but going on in the background symbolism throughout his two terms, a lot of people are uncertain and antsy and afraid of Obama, but they don't know why. They just know there's something there that doesn't comport with everything they see in public. And last night's little Super Bowl nod that he got his information of who was going to win the Super Bowl in 2016 from National Treasure 3 is stunning, because Colbert says, but there is no National Treasure 3. And the president looks into the camera and he says with a smile, there will be.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't see any of this, but, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when you get into Masonic films, certainly the first two National Treasure movies, probably, I mean, if you ask me to make a list of, you know, Masonic movies, National Treasure 1 and National Treasure 2 would be 1A and 1B. That's interesting. That's interesting that would happen.
Well, the cool thing is, in these days, nothing ever gets lost. So just Google, it's on YouTube, I'm sure, Stephen Colbert, President Obama, read their exchange, watch their exchange, and then you tell me if the president is not communicating a secret esoteric set of messages in that little tour de force.
All right, I'll take a look at it.
Okay. All right, why don't we go from the top? What is your most famous and interesting film for symbolism? The first film in the book that you've done.
The first in the cinema book, the first movie that I took on was The Exorcist.
Oh.
that was that has some very unique symbolism going on in it that I was very impressed with. Some of it is very, very well veiled. They definitely tweak your subconscious mind on this. I like you have the whole idea of the Jesuit priest Max von Sydow at the beginning excavating the pagan runes, the ruins. Certainly, you know, this ties into the whole idea of the Christ, you know, of tying into Christianity, pagan origins. You have the Jesuit priest, certainly with von Sydow, Father Marin, echoing this famous Jesuit priest named Athanasius Kircher, from the 17th century, who was investigating, Christianity's pagan origins. And you have Marin at the very beginning, you know, he confronts the demon, the statue of the demon with the setting sun in the background, symbolizing the death of light. I liked how that was very much well done, the exaltation of darkness. Then we go to Georgetown, and I really liked how they conveyed this. This was done on a very deep subconscious level where, you know, that it's in autumn and winter, and of course autumn and winter is the death of the sun. The days are shorter, the night darkness is exalted. Where you have the mother, Chris McNeil, walking home from the movie shoot at Georgetown, and she's accosted by the trick or treaters. This is of course the delineation point between the autumn equinox and the winter solstice, when the days officially start getting shorter. It's the exaltation of darkness, hence, you know, the darkness, hence the demon is now allowed to come out and play, come out and roam, infest your little girl. This is very Manichaean light versus darkness, very Zoroastrianism. This is in Christianity, God versus the devil. You have the little girl being taken over by the dark evil demon, so we call in the two sun priests, the Jesuits. The symbol for the Jesuits is the sun to cast out the, you know, it's, they're bringing in light, they're invoking solar light to cast the darkness out of the little girl. You have the little girl being surrounded when she's possessed, surrounded by the cold, by the freezing cold. This conjures to the subconscious mind Dante Alighieri's Inferno, the lowest circle of hell, Lake Cocytus, is a frozen wasteland. So, you know, this is where the devil dwells.
Hang on. Let me stop you there, because this is interesting. See, I haven't seen that film in so long, I've forgotten most of the things you're talking about, but other people will remember, so it's important. But you say when you see her first possessed, she's surrounded by cold?
As she gets more possessed by the demon, the room that she is in becomes freezing cold. You can see your breath. At the end, the Jesuits have to put on warm jackets to go into the room. Hey, pay attention to it. You can it's freezing cold when the little girl becomes possessed by the devil.
See, now this is so interesting, because in this physics, in the torsion physics model that I've been working on and looking at laboratory experiments and doing field measurements and all that, one of the indicators of the connection between dimensions is lack of temperature, lack of heat, lack of energy. So when you open a portal between dimensions, the ambient room temperature will go down, because coherence versus incoherence, you know, neg entropy versus entropy is what's going on again in the physics. And that is why I've been so intrigued with all the reports going back, you know, what, centuries, thousands of years, all the the data we have of the appearance of specters and ghosts and possession and all that. This drastic decrease in temperature is part of that mythology, and that temperature decrease actually is part of a physical connection that we've now been able to measure in other people's experiments and our own between this dimension and others.
Well, that's right. And that absolutely syncs with the movie, because you have this, you know, extra, you know, this, you know, trans-dimensional, you know, demon, you know, coming into the little girl, taking possession, so and hence the temperature dropping. I thought that was very, very well done in the movie. There's another scene in it that is great that I just really love, and it's very esoteric. It's the scene where, and this is just so very well done. It's the scene where Chris McNeil, the mother, is in the psychiatric clinic, and she's there with the doctors, and they're telling her at this point that they don't know what's wrong with the little girl, that a spiritual aid is, you know, the girl needs spiritual help, and that she's beyond their control. If you pay attention to this scene, the actual scene is a recreation of the Da Vinci Last Supper painting with Jesus at the head with the 12 apostles. If you watch the scene, you have Chris, you know, qua Christ, at the head of the table, surrounded by the four groups of three doctors, paralleling this painting, and it's this very deep religious imagery where the doctors are telling her at this point that a spiritual need, a spiritual aid, is requested of the daughter, that she's beyond her control. You have a very interesting numerological reference going on in this exact same scene that confirms this, where the mother, Chris McNeil, says something to the effect of, and I'm not going to quote it verbatim because she uses foul language, but she says something to the effect of, there's 88 doctors here and no one can tell me what's wrong with my little girl. That's an interesting number she pulled out. It's the number 88. In Greek gematria, the number 888, 3 8, is actually Jesus Christ. So you have this.
Okay,
very
so hang on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Hold it there. Sure. We're going through symbolism in movies now. One of my fun topics, because I think it's not just fun. I think there's a meaning there, and we'll get into the meanings on the other side of the break. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Robert Sullivan. We're having a rollicking time discussing symbolism in a variety of contexts. Some we agree, some we disagree. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back. Welcome, everyone, back to the other side of midnight. Okay, remember a little while ago I told you there was a director I wanted to talk about? Remember Ron Howard and his amazing accomplishment with Apollo 13? Robert?
Yeah, yes, hello.
Sorry. Did you hear my question?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I must have missed it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Oh, I was saying, at the top of the show, I talked about a certain director I wanted to talk about in terms of symbolism, and that director is Ron Howard. You know, little Opie from Mayberry,
yes,
et cetera?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Ron Howard made a stunningly interesting film called Apollo 13. Did you see it?
I've seen it, but it's been years since I looked at it, although the Apollo 13 logo is very Freemasonic, that I talk about in Royal Arch of Enoch.
Hmm. Have you looked at the Apollo 13 patch from NASA?
Oh, of course. it's the sun chariot of the Jewish Merkaba.
Yep.
Being carted across the sky by the that's the 13th degree. Apollo 13, the symbol is symbolizing the 13th degree of the Scottish Rite, the Royal Arch of Enoch. It's the sun bringing light from the moon. What's it? The logo is the moon
it
knowledge.
It was called.
That is a clear Masonic emblem.
Yeah,
no
question. I think the Latin was ex luna scienti or something like that, which means out of the moon knowledge. Anyway, the point is that Apollo 13 launched at 13:13. Are you aware of that?
No.
On the military clock. And the Masonic symbolism in the Apollo 13 mission is so replete. I'm probably not using that word in the right way, but the movie is replete with incredible symbolism. And then I found out that before Ron Howard was even allowed to make this movie, which, as you know, was made with the heavy involvement of NASA and key Apollo astronauts, except James Lovell did not want to participate in advising the movie, so they got another astronaut to kind of stand in, which I thought was kind of strange, given that Lovell survived an overwhelming problem, triumphed, made America, you know, proud, saved his crew, et cetera, et cetera. So why wouldn't Lovell want to be involved in the making of a movie, a Hollywood movie, with millions and millions of people seeing that heroic effort? Anyway, that's kind of an abstract question. The point I'm making is that I found out much later, years later, that in order to make that movie, Ron Howard had to become a third-degree Mason. He had to become a Master Mason. And guess how long it took him to become a Master Mason to make the movie?
I have no idea.
A week.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me.
A week. But they wouldn't let him make the movie with NASA help and input without becoming a Mason. Again, well, I raise my question. Yeah. Are there two sides of Masonry?
Not to my knowledge, but are you sure Ron Howard is a Mason?
Absolutely, unequivocally. And the reason I know is one of my very good friends who's a Mason, named Ken Johnston Jr., who actually was an Apollo test astronaut, is the guy who found the information and called me up excitedly and said, "You'll never believe what I just found." So, yeah. And you can Google.
Maybe they didn't want to, maybe NASA is steeped in Masonry. That's irrefutable.
you think? And,
oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Apollo, you know, you send your, you know, I mean, you know, you have it right off the bat. I mean, you know, you name your rockets after the sun god Apollo to go to the moon, the sacred feminine. It's the alchemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, the unification of the sun and moon. Mm-hmm. You can't send, if you're going to send men to the moon, you send them in the sun god, Apollo.
Have you ever seen the NASA Apollo patch for the Apollo program itself?
I've seen various NASA patches. I know the one that I take on in the Royal Arch is the Apollo 13 one. That's very Masonic. Beyond that, they kind of gel together in my mind. But I'd have to, like Apollo 11 and those. But, you know, I probably have all seen them at one point in time. But if you ask me to specifically recall ones at this point, I probably couldn't do it. I know the Apollo 13 one, though.
Okay. Well, and please make a list of all the things I'm going to send to Robert after the show. Because I think our next show, when you get a chance to look at this, is going to be very interesting because the Apollo symbol for the Apollo program is so stunningly Masonically symbolic with all kinds of extended meanings. It'll just be fun to have you look at it without me telling you what it is and see if you get the same read off it that I do.
Right. I mean, yeah. Okay. All right. Sure.
All right. So moving on. We only have about 20 minutes left. That's much too less. Too small amount of time to do what I want to do, but let's try it anyway.
Okay,
go through the rest of the films in your book and give us a couple of symbols from each of the films in descending order of what attracted you to the film, because I want people to start to get a feel for how you do this. When you go to a movie, how do you look for symbolism, and how do you make sure you're not just projecting, but in fact it's what the director or the writer or other folks involved intended?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a great question. And again, it's contextual. And it's themes, Richard. What I would say is, I'll answer the question. I'll just caveat this by saying that when I did Royal Arch was my first book, that was the product of 20 years of research, you know, investigating the occult, symbolism, Masonry, you know, ancient religions, astrology, tarot, you know, the occult, magic, all that. And essentially, what I did was I turned this 20 years on Hollywood and these movies. Is this stuff going on? I mean, and there are certain clues. You can figure this out. The themes going on, context is so critical to this, but the filmmakers will inevitably incorporate some little clue that is like a trigger thing that will tell you they're doing this. I'm trying to think of some of these. Like, for example, the first Matrix movie, with Keanu Reeves, which is essentially, it's very Gnostic. That is pretty much, if you ask me to list the top three Gnostic movies of all time, that probably would be number one. For the Gnostic religion. And there are some little clues, you know, you have Neo, the Keanu Reeves character. I mean, I'll just get into this real quick.
Okay.
The Keanu Reeves character, Neo, who's going to be this Gnostic savior. Mankind is in a state of stasis. They're asleep. They're under the control of this evil demiurge. The architect, he shows up in part two. They're living in a false reality. This is all tenets of the Gnostic religion. Neo is going to bring wisdom, gnosis, to mankind by bringing them out of this Gnostic, this sleeper state. So we have Neo as this Gnostic savior figure. He goes, you know, he meets the Morpheus character, interesting name to give to this guy. Morpheus is the god of dreams and sleep in mythology, but he's the guy who's going to bring Neo out of the dream world to the real world. When Neo finally wakes up in the machine world, he gets lifted cruciform like Jesus up into the belly of the ship, the Nebuchadnezzar. To symbolize him as this Christ-like resurrected sun god, the savior figure. When these guys, you know, numbers don't lie. When he's on board the bridge of the ship, you'll see the nameplate of the ship flash across the screen real quick. It says Mark 3:11. And that is a clear bit reference to the Bible verse of Mark 3:11, which reads, and I'm not quoting verbatim here, but essentially says, "Thou art the Son of God, and all darkness bows down to you." Mm. So we have Neo as this Christ figure who's going to defeat the archons, the agents of darkness, the agents of the demiurge. Neo, like Jesus, is killed and resurrected. You have the whole idea of the sacred feminine with this, with Trinity. Great name to give to her. When you turn to the Nag Hammadi library, this Gnostic literature, part of the Holy Trinity is the sacred feminine, which is called Sophia. So hence we have her as this Sophia character who's going to help, you know, bring gnosis to Neo, which she eventually does. She ultimately resurrects him like Jesus. So we have this very deep Gnostic religious theme going on inside the Matrix. We have these Neoplatonic themes going on inside the Exorcist, with the weather, with the religion, with the death of the sun, the exaltation of light. This is some of the themes going on in this. We have a journey of gnosis in The Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. This is a book and movie very steeped in mysticism. L. Frank Baum, the man who wrote the story, was a member of Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy movement.
And that's Madame interesting. I never knew that.
Oh, yes. Baum and his wife were very much into Madame Blavatsky's Theosophy movement, which was sort of this new, I guess, want to call it. I'm just going through this very quickly because of time. This 19th century Gnostic mystical movement, and you'll find this in The Wizard of Oz. You have two levels of symbolism going on. You have a very deep political allegory going on, reflecting 1896 to 1900 political, socio-economic life in the United States. This has been somewhat more well documented, but then you have this very deep mystical, you know, what I call the initiatic quest, initiation into gnosis, initiation into the ancient mysteries, where Dorothy goes up the winding staircase, up the tornado. Madame Blavatsky said, in order to be initiated into gnosis, you have to have intelligence, fortitude, and courage. Hence, the three sojourners that she meets up with are seeking a brain, a heart, and courage. You have the golden path of religion, the yellow brick road, leading to the false messiah, the demiurge, the Wizard of Oz, who is a fraud. He's an illusion. We have this very deep Gnostic tenet going on. You have the two women in Oz. It's a little different in the book, but they do a pretty good job of it in the movie as well. The two in the book, there are two witches. The two women who want to help Dorothy on her quest of ascension are of the North and South, symbolizing vertical movement up and down the ladder of wisdom, up and down the ladder of gnosis, up and down the winding staircase of Freemasonry. You receive gnosis and initiation by moving up and down the ladder, not left and right. Hence, the two women who are opposing Dorothy are the East and West. They're horizontal. They're stagnation. You can't receive gnosis by moving left and right. You've got to go up and down. It's a journey of ascension. Hence, the two women who want to help Dorothy are of the North and South. They're the White Witches. You'll even, they only use one in the movie. She is a White Witch. Pay attention to her little scepter. She has the pentagram on it, and it's correct. The one point is up. The two points are down, symbolizing white magic. This is all very well done. You have another political allegory. So we have this going on in The Wizard of Oz. This was one of my favorite chapters to write in the book. You will find this same theme, this initiatic, you know, sort of what I call initiation into the ancient mysteries in The Wizard of Oz. You will also, this is also the Alice in Wonderland story by Lewis Carroll. It's the exact same story, only she goes down the rabbit hole. And just going back to Wizard of Oz, you have it. You have the Gnostic epiphany. You have the Gnostic revelation. For Dorothy Gale, it's learning there's no place like home. We find this paralleled in Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland story. There was a movie put out a few years ago that has this exact same theme in it and is loaded with esoteric imagery called The Lovely Bones, which was put out, which was directed by Peter Jackson. He did the Lord of the Rings movies by Tolkien. Those movies are also steeped in the monomyth and have some deep esoteric themes in them. This is all stuff I took on inside cinema symbolism. I'm doing cinema symbolism too right now. Some of the movies I'm taking on in that are The Shining, very interesting movie, a lot of repetition to symbolize the reincarnation inside the Overlook Hotel. Getting back to the cinema book that's out right now, another one of my favorite chapters was the whole James Bond
mythology. Oh, I was just going to ask you, because
yeah.
James Bond will take us to the end of the hour, but by all means, start with John Dee and the world Ian Fleming, and because Bond films, nobody has ever not seen a Bond film. Everybody's going to now be familiar with Bond films. So start at the very beginning and go as long as we can. What kind of what do you think, why was the symbolism incorporated in the Bond films to begin with, and how, because they had so many political turnovers in terms of producers and backers and infights and all that, how did they maintain the continuity of the symbolism?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the movies that are made, what a lot of people aren't aware of, is there's only so many Bond movies. There's only so many Bond stories. A lot of the Bond movies that are made post Sean Connery, some of the early ones with Roger Moore, that's where the Ian Fleming material runs out. But by the time you get to some of the later Roger Moore movies, and the Timothy Daltons and the ones that are making now, you're away from the Ian Fleming material. But they're probably still using it as an influence. But yeah, no, the Ian Fleming material with James Bond, this definitely, Richard, comes out of the world of, you know, you can't make this stuff up.
okay.
And it really does. Fleming during World War II was in British counterintelligence, and one of the people that he was, who answered to him, was none other than Aleister Crowley. Crowley in World War I and World War II was a British double agent. This has been well documented now, and Crowley had this profound influence upon this hermetic
occult. What was Crowley's nickname? The most evil man in the world, or something?
Yeah. He called himself the Great Beast 666. People dubbed him the most evil man in the evil man in the world. Crowley is a very enigmatic historical figure. He's very hard to figure out. He is almost impossible to figure out, because he intentionally played this card of tongue in cheek and when to take me seriously. And it's so hard to decipher when he's being tongue in cheek and when he wanted to be taken seriously.
Which is a way to keep the symbolism and the message a secret.
And he's just so hard To figure out in this, because you never know, and it even makes it more difficult because of his espionage activities. When he's putting out this information, and I mean, during World War II, in fact, and this is a true story. When Rudolf Hess, the Nazi deputy, flew to Great Britain to broker a peace with Great Britain, he crash landed in Scotland. He was eventually captured and thrown in the Tower of London. And this has been all well documented too. Was the Nazi hierarchy proclivity for the occult, astrology, mysticism? Rudolf Hess was big into this. Crowley actually went to Ian Fleming and said, listen, we've captured Rudolf Hess. He said, let me have access to him. He said, I'll perform some Ars Goetia magic in front of him. I'll summon some demons. I'll scare the hell out of him, and we'll try to figure out the Nazi proclivity, the weaknesses of Himmler, Hitler, Goebbels, and see if we can't use it against him. And Fleming thought it was a great idea, and actually went to Winston Churchill with this proposal of letting Crowley have access to Rudolf Hess. Eventually, as the story goes, Churchill vetoed it.
Do we know that he really vetoed it?
Yeah, it appears that way. It does appear that way. But I will say this with Crowley, and this is coming out. It does appear that the meeting with Hess and Crowley never took place. Since I wasn't there, I can't tell you this with 100% certainty. I will say this though, Crowley, this is true. I mean, this does seem to be documented. Crowley used to have these dinner parties. This is 100% true. And what he would do is he would invite guests over, and he would spike the people's food, the guests' food, with hallucinogenic drugs such as, you know, LSD, these psychotronic drugs, spike their chicken curry, put it in their drink, and then he would record their reaction to this. And this has always been written off as... This has always been explained as this was just Crowley being Crowley. You know, this is just, you know, Crowley being Pan. You know, this is Crowley just being the trickster. Mm. You know, the great beast. It appears now
the trickster,
that this was actually
Loki.
I'm sorry,
the trickster Loki.
Yeah, but this is actually now being this is now coming out that this was actually sanctioned by the British government. And this was actually sanctioned by Churchill, and that these experiments that Crowley was doing was actually the forerunner of MK Ultra. And that Crowley was actually doing this on the behest of Churchill and this was the forerunner of the MK Ultra CIA program, and that this was the early stages of testing hallucinogenic drugs on an unsuspecting populace, and that seems to be the case, as it were. We know for a fact, and this is absolutely also true, because you asked me about this thing with Crowley and Hess. Certainly I wasn't there, and you know, could it have happened? I guess it could have. But we know this also, that when Crowley died in 1947-48, Winston Churchill himself went through the files of MI5 and MI6 and personally requested that all files on Aleister Crowley's involvement with the British government, with MI5 and MI6, be completely destroyed.
Now, where? Robert, where is that documented?
This material, what I'm talking about now, with Crowley's involvement with MK Ultra and the British government, the book you're going to want to look at is a book called Special Agent 666. And it was written by a man named Richard Spence. And it's a very good book.
Oh, I know Richard Spence. Yeah. He's an historian at the University of Utah. He's been on the show several times.
Yes, yes.
Obviously, thank you. I'm going to ask Richard to do a whole show on this because this is extraordinary.
Yes, take a look at the Richard Spence book called Special Agent 666. I think it's a very good book, and he gets into much more in depth about Crowley's work with the British government. But through this, This is his interaction with Ian Fleming, which is what I get into, with more of the James Bond material and the whole, you know, the 007 being the James Bond sigil for 007. And just, you know, I know we're up against it time-wise.
Yeah, we got about 3 minutes. Okay, let me ask you this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Of all the current movies that are out there,
yes,
which is the one we should all go see and try to figure out the symbolism? Right now.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, I would say, I mean, well, you've asked me somewhat of a bad question because I haven't seen any real new movies of late.
Okay, like what was the last one you saw then that's we could still find?
Yeah, take a look. Some great movies I recommend for symbolism. The Shining with by Stanley Kubrick. Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan. Blue Velvet by David Lynch is overloaded with esoteric is overloaded with themes, esoteric themes. Some of the other ones, modern movies, Fight Club is great, very Gnostic, very secret society. Certainly the Star Wars movies. You're going to want to take a look at them for the monomyth.
Have you seen the latest one?
You know, I have not. I'm probably the last person in America.
No. Robin and I are the last people. We haven't had time to go see it yet. But
no, I haven't seen it yet. To be honest with you, the reason I haven't seen it is I'm working on this book, and I just haven't had a minute's time to go see it. But I'll get to it eventually. You're going to want to take a look at Angel Heart with Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro.
Uh-huh.
Some very good material in that. Again, the Back to the Future movies, we're going to be dealing with a lot of comparative religion in that, with the Egyptian religion. And again, we have a reference to the number 88 again. This is in a different context than it is done in the Omen movie, in the Exorcist movie. Again, The Wizard of Oz, a classic.
Superman.
Yes, Superman, absolutely. You're going to want to...
Hey, look, we only have 1 minute left. We could do this all night. It'd be so much fun, so we're going to have you back. But before you come back, Robert, you got to go and see some current films. You got to look at all the Marvel Universe films, because those are filled with symbolism that I want to get into the nitty-gritty on. In the last few seconds of the show, please plug whatever you want, your latest book, your website, where you're going to be speaking, anything like that.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Richard, for having me on again, The Other Side of Midnight. I thought it was a terrific show. Very spirited. I love it. I love coming on here. It's a great show. You're a gracious host. Thank you so much for having me on. If you're interested in what I've been talking about tonight, please check out my website. It's robertwsullivaniv.com. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV, so it's www.robertwsullivaniv.com. Links there to buy my books, Kindle, paperbacks, social media, YouTube channel. You can follow me on Twitter. There's information about me. I am constantly updating the page with programs. I'm going to be on radio shows. I'm speaking engagements.
Okay, Robert?
There, www.robertwsullivaniv.com.
Okay. Robert's link is on othersideofmidnight.com. That's our theme. 2 hours has suddenly flown by. Thank you all. Thank you all. And join us tomorrow morning. Same time, same bat channel, and remember, until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.